You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, everyone. This is another Daily Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is, for better or for worse, Election Day here in the United States. I gave my election talk last week. I'm going to have nothing more to do with it. Today, though, I want to talk about something far more substantial than the pageantry of the election. And that is some news on the Russian economy and the situation in the European Union, entitled "The Moribund Western Oligarchy: Why Russia Became the Fourth Largest Economy on the Planet," something that occurred this year. So much of this material is on my Patreon page. If you haven't, I mean, it's a minimal amount of money. If you haven't signed up, I ask you to please do it. So much more, not to mention all my sources, are available there. And the other thing I'm doing is I'm putting some definitely readable but rougher drafts of things that I'm working on, and you guys get a advanced view of it. Anyway, we all know that Russia's special military operation was launched to forestall a massive Ukrainian invasion of eastern Ukraine, which they had lost in 2014. That and sanctions and other things, the ongoing war against Russia, gave the regime intellectuals this idea that Russia was going to collapse. Intellectuals have said this, journalists have said this since the Obama administration, if not earlier. And of course, they're always wrong. And it always galls me that their ridiculous and consistent errors never have professional consequences. By now, Russia's economy was supposed to be ruined and long since divided, becoming a colony of the West. In fact, the Kremlin was even expected to default, having no idea that the forex reserves in Western banks were just a tiny amount. They froze them. They did not steal them, because that's very difficult to do. If you remember the ridiculous price cap on Russian oil, which all of a sudden everybody has abandoned and forgotten about. But even if that were put into motion, most people would have circumvented it anyway. And the Japanese were very clear on that. The U.S. is not a superpower. It's not industrialized anymore. The United States is very dependent on others, despite the fact that it does have the potential for total autarky. But 2022 was a little different. The total war was launched in an attempt to disrupt the economy and cause as much damage to Russia as possible. If you recall, I was talking about the regime's declaration of war on Russia 15 years ago. 2022, of course, was a qualitative change in the nature of that war. Putin has done something extraordinary. Among other things, there's tremendous, not just economic stability, but growth, despite being forced to conduct this war against pretty much the entire world. Again, I don't like comparisons with the Cold War, because that was a completely different, none of this was happening during the Cold War. It has more in common with the Crimean War. But it was this year. I'm wrong. I think it was last year, if not the year before, Russia overtook Germany as the world's fifth and Europe's largest economy, which was a humiliating defeat for the EU, and we know that because it's not really trumpeted in any media. And the intellectuals, of course, were talking about the opposite was going to happen. But Russia's rise has been Berlin's and the U.S.'s fall. Her economic performance is disastrous. And one writer said that the British economy is at its lowest ebb since 1709. And all of this, of course, is due to the anti-Russian policies of the EU, offshoring, free trade, the migrant invasion, and of course, all of this is based not on any market or any democratic procedure, of course, but because everything is filtered through the narrow interests of the oligarchy. But even Western data, that is to say, the World Bank, the IMF, individual banks, all of their estimates of, as always, Moscow's economic performance recently were ridiculous. And Russian growth exceeded all of their estimates, both in 2023 and this year so far. But this has been the pattern since 2000. And it's not just, you know, the rating agencies like Moody's that are highly politicized, or the IMF. No one ever seems to lose their jobs over all of this incorrect data. None of their prognostications ever come true. The IMF forecast, using nominal GDP figures, is a growth of about 3%, double the previous assessment. And even the Financial Times, that was regularly talking about Russia's collapse, this increase was the largest for any economy that the IMF was covering in its update to the World Economic Outlook, which was released in January, the end of January of this year. And it's an understatement. Now, I want to comment on the current defense minister. You know, I've criticized European states for having these women with zero military experience as defense minister. Now, Putin has done the same. Andriy Belousov, who is an economist, a development economist. Now, he predicted that Russia will overtake Japan in terms of economic size by 2030. But what was supposed to happen in 6 years or so actually occurred in 4 months. So President Putin's forecast of increased economic growth, he said roughly 4%, not only turned out to be true, but it was low. At the time, the propaganda machine said it was irrational and overly optimistic. But Belousov is a fairly new name, and in replacing an actual military man like General Shoigu is no easy task. My impression is that back in May, Putin chose him because, while an economist, and why would an economist be in that position? Well, it's for economic reasons. He is the best suited to integrate defense spending into the broader Russian economy. And that would include all related sectors, you know, the high-tech sector, chemistry, and even finance itself. That means that defense, of course, due entirely to Western pressure, is not just a sector in and of itself, but will become the engine of continued Russian development, especially as she is surrounded by artificially created enemies. The only thing that was over-optimistic is the ridiculous expectation, I condemned it here and elsewhere many years ago, that the sanctions would work. The idea that sanctions would work implies that the U.S. is so far superior to everybody that its will is law. And they found out, although they'll probably never admit, that this is simply not true, because that would mean liberalism is not true. So Russia managed to overtake Japan, according to the World Bank, and is now the fourth largest economy in the world. They use purchasing power parity, however, which is a comparison of currencies, and that is values, rather than the nominal figure. We'll talk about here in a second. Any understanding of the nationalist or Eurasianist economy is beyond the education of economists in the West. They don't have any institutional context for their analysis or even their predictions. They can't even do it domestically because they assume markets operate rather than oligarchies. But they simply can't grasp how a completely different system than their assumptions works. I mean, for decades they believed in the absolute truth of globalism. So when sanctions increased Russian economic growth via self-sufficiency, they don't have any conceptual means for understanding it. Now, I want to talk about purchasing power parity here. This is an important variable, actually a metric and a measure that makes a lot of sense when you're talking about comparisons. Now, this is aside from the fact that Western statistics domestically are very questionable, especially on politically important measures like unemployment or inflation. But less than a year after overtaking Germany and then becoming Europe's largest economy, American observers were absolutely, as usual, in shock as to how a country that they predicted confidently would collapse from sanctions and mismanagement, whatever other nonsense they said, not only grew so rapidly, but is dominating many areas of global trade. And they themselves have to lie about their own economies to cover up the implosion. Now, GDP as a nominal measure refers to the total value of anything produced, goods, services, whatever, within a single country. Now, GNP includes foreign trade and outsourcing and stuff like that, non-domestic sources of value, but accomplished by citizens, including corporations. So the nominal GDP calculates that value in present absolute terms, usually in dollar terms. And of course, the real GDP adjusts for inflation, etc. But for purposes of comparison, purchasing power parity has to be used because it answers the question as to what value is elsewhere. So the point is to convert absolute numbers, nominal numbers, into a value that makes sense out of the different concepts of value and cost of living elsewhere. Now, let me give a simple example, very well-known example. Let's say you're talking about $10 to buy a pair of jeans in the United States, but it costs $8 to buy the same thing in, say, the EU, 8 euros. So you can't really compare, because to make the comparison, you have to convert the 8 euros into dollars. Now, let's say the exchange rate that the jeans in Germany cost 15 American dollars, the purchasing power parity would be 15 over 10, and it would come out to 1.5. That means for every dollar spent on jeans in the USA, it takes $1.50 to obtain the same item in Germany when buying it with the euro. Now, let me give an even simpler example. There's a common refrain. You see this emotional refrain. Someone says, insert poor country here has an average income of $2 a day. And that's it. Now, we're supposed to get misty-eyed over all of this, because to American ears, it sounds like extreme poverty. Can you imagine living on $2 a day? Now, purchasing power parity asks the question, how far will $2 a day go in that economy? That is, in places with low cost of living and state subsidies and welfare or whatever else, $2 can be livable. This is why purchasing power parity is so important when you consider the value of goods and services in any other economy for comparison. Now, let me give another example. Let's say the Japanese yen falls by half, 50% against the dollar. That means if that happens, the nominal Japanese GDP, when you measure it in dollars, will seem to have fallen by half. But of course, that's not the case. Half the economy didn't go away. It doesn't mean that the Japanese are now 50% poorer en masse than they were before, but nominal GDP figures imply that. It means other things in global trade, like international bankers, their central bank, whatever, has devalued the yen. In other words, if income and prices in Japan itself remain static, nothing in their economic status will change. But the nominal GDP figure will say that their total value of goods and services have gone down by half. So this is an obvious absurdity, and measuring using purchasing power parity, PPP, helps avoid this obvious problem. And that's why it's important. That's why it gives an understanding to the relative economic power and size of economies compared one to another, because I have to talk about local markets. In a broader way, though, I say that the nominal figures is based on the supremacy of the American dollar as the measure of all things and the American economy as the measure of all things. PPP refuses to assume that truth, that the dollar is such a measure, and contextualizes local economies relative to the forces of imperialism and dependency and banking. So valuing the Russian economy using the PPP GDP measure, it is the fourth largest in the world. And that is very difficult for the regime's intellectuals to come to terms with. As you've heard me say before, refusing to accept that liberalism is wrong, incorrect, false, destructive, and that the U.S. is no longer a superpower, you have economists and journalists in Europe and the U.S. They've invented all kinds of numerous psychological and intellectual methods of dealing with these inconvenient truths, projection being the most obnoxious result. They also can't deal with the fact that today, Russia is among the fastest growing economies in the world, which makes a mockery out of Western economics, their intellectuals, and their models. There was an interview on CBS with Richard Connolly of the Royal Institute of Shared Services in London, which I've never heard of before. He's an alleged expert on the Russian economy, and he said that the number of small and medium-sized enterprises registered in Russia has reached an unprecedented level. Note that the exact opposite is true in the U.S., where startups are now increasingly rare. Now, as far as Russia goes, major Western companies were forced to leave or suspend their activities due to sanctions. They also left a massive market gap that was filled by domestic industry. And that, plus increased trade with China and India and rebuilding their structure, this is the cause of Russian economic success in the last few years. In other words, sanctions turned out to be a type of enforced protectionism that again shocked this coddled Western intelligentsia. And it proved several things. Number one, it proved that their liberal models of economics are false. They don't work anymore. Number two, using the market metaphor as a fundamental axiom is also false. They live in oligarchies, not markets. Number three, that they don't understand Eurasian or any kind of nationalist economic practice. Number four, they certainly don't understand Russia or her unique economic position. Their models tend to be abstract. Number five, they don't seem to understand what sanctions are or the effect that they might have, especially on an economy as different as Russia. Number six, that their ideological biases are distorting their analysis. Chief among them is a refusal to acknowledge the role of oligarchy in the West. Number seven, that free trade is destructive to most, if not all, economies. Number eight, they are likely under immense pressure to conform to regime demands. And finally, number nine, the U.S. isn't a superpower. Its influence is waning, its military is waning, and the dollar is falling. That's a minimum number of things that American intellectuals, mainstream intellectuals, have had to deal with. And of course, they won't. It's very important to note that sanctions were in the medium term, a very good thing, because Russian companies replaced the Western brands that were forced to leave. They don't have Starbucks. God, what they will do without Starbucks, I don't know, but they have their own, Stars Coffee. They have Dobry Cola to replace Coke. All kinds. This is happening all over the economy, and this shift benefited Russia beyond the expectations even of its own government. And this is why, you know, Western economists and intellectuals don't know what's going on. They don't have the conceptual apparatus to know what's going on. Russian economy, while mostly in private hands, is still state-led. This is a little bit closer to China and very different from the oligarchy in the West. Using the U.S. as a baseline and hence nominal GNP figures in some cases distorts their conclusions. But it isn't just that these other domestic, that is to say Russian, companies took over from their foreign competitors, but they're outproducing them. Dobry Cola is a huge success. Their 2022 profits were quadrupled by 2023. And in this singular case, they severed dependence on a Western economy, or Coca-Cola in this case. Connolly, who I mentioned above, said sanctions have proven ineffective, essentially resulting in sanction evasion becoming a sector in and of itself. Well, of course, he's correct, but evasion has never been the issue. The economy is as potent as it is because foreign competition is minimal. Sanctions forced Russian entrepreneurs to fill the gap. And what is that going to do to domestic employment? Now, if by evasion he means that it forced Russia to build stronger trade relationships with China, Iran, India, whatever, well, then he would be correct there. But competition didn't go away, it's just domestic now, as it should be. In other words, the restrictions imposed by the regime revitalized sectors of the Russian economy that were initially insignificant or simply undeveloped. Because no one in the regime's intellectuals knew that this was going to happen or even considered it, that's why I take the very hard line that all of their assumptions are false and they will never be correct for that reason. The broader point, of course, is that Russia's getting everything it needs, but through their own firms. This is a matter of sovereignty, something else that economists have no conception of. Some stuff they may get through, you know, Georgia or Turkey. But if it wanted to, Russia is headed to full autarky. I should also note that because these are domestic brands, they're cheaper, or I should say less expensive than their former competitors. Not to mention that they're building their own local supply chain, which I think is largely completed since this began in the Obama administration. Internal trade then will become increasingly efficient. Again, the Russian ruble can stretch further than the dying dollar. Again, another reason why PPP is important. And I'm saying that Russians live better than the massively indebted and alienated Americans. Given the sheer size of household debt levels in America, which match the federal government's debt, they technically own nothing. You can't owe more than 100% of what you possess and claim you own it. So Connolly, handful, and he is a regime economist as far as I know, one of the few that said you have to deal with the fact that we're looking at the fastest economic growth in the last decade. Which, if you've been listening to me, should sound very familiar. Putin's economy has become increasingly efficient over time, and especially recently considering the fact that Russia is waging a war against the entire regime and winning using only a relatively small percentage of its total military might. So you have this resurgence of investment, not just in defense-related sectors, but these consumer sectors. Putin says it's not just going to go, the profit is not going to go to these elites. So he came up with the National Projects 2.1 program, and the point is to take some of this and invest it in the civilian economy, especially targeting Russia's poorer regions, and they have been the biggest winners in all of this because they've been specifically targeted for investment. Take a look at rural America and say what would happen if that would occur in the U.S., but of course it can't because the U.S. is an oligarchy. And oligarchies are deceptive and, at least in the long term, seem irrational. But the CIA has been forced to agree that using this measure, Russia is the fourth largest economy on the planet as of this year. Now, the World Bank is a different story. They put the Russian and Japanese economies at the Russian at $6 trillion and the Japanese at $5.87 trillion. But the discrepancy is far higher, given what I've already said. The World Bank admits that about 30% of the Russian economy is beyond, you know, given sanctions, they're not really on the ground. So it's really invisible to it, which definitely suggests that the economy is far larger than they realize. So if you use purchasing power parity, that will add about $3 trillion to Russia's economic size, which of course widens the gap with Germany and Japan and the rest of the world pretty much. And this resurgence, of course, has military applications. Its military and high-tech sectors are going through the roof. The defense budget has gone up, but Russia doesn't have long-term debt. Russia has so much more freedom of movement. They have constant surpluses. Of course, short-term debt is normal, but that's not normally in the debt figures. That's medium and long-term debt that matters. But it's not a problem. If you recall, many years ago, I talked about how Russia was going to pay off its older 90s debt much earlier than expected, and that led to outrage. Russia's still going to collapse, though. You've heard me speak of the Kievan terror campaign, which is, you know, the American terror campaign against Eastern Ukraine and Russia to disrupt this economic recovery since they're powerless to stop it. I've detailed Kiev blowing up civilian bridges and dams, trying to destroy the water supply, heading to Crimea. These are terror tactics because they will only harm civilians, and that, of course, is the point. And this is really all the regime has. The regime is malignant. And in the 90s and even in the early 2000s, you had liberals still dominating the Kremlin. The point being is that it would ruin Russia's economic might since everything would be sold off to Western investors. That would forestall any possible recovery. Now, the point was to sell off Russia's industry like it had done in Ukraine, reducing Russia to a third world power. That was the nature of the Wolfowitz Doctrine, if you recall. And it was a document with that name published by the abominable administration of Bill Clinton. But Putin ruined all of these plans, and that's why he suffers this ludicrous vilification in the regime's controlled media. This is pure imperialism today, postmodern imperialism. The body count of this kind of imperialism is in the tens of millions across the globe. And for nothing, since the American military record is a very poor one. But having Russia as a subservient state was absolutely imperative. They went to Ukraine instead. But even, you know, after Putin 24 years ago became president, his men had to contend with this. He did drain his swamp. It took a long time. It took at least 5 years, maybe more, to cure the Kremlin, to get rid of the Kremlin's liberals. And I hold to the view that the remnants were purged only in 2020. And that was, as if you've heard me talk about the constitutional reforms that brought back Russia's sovereignty totally. And sanctions, of course, did nothing but help. And all of this led to Russia's immense growth, understood by me and a handful of others in the English speaking, where my predictions come true. Because at least I begin with the proper axioms. And of course, all of this made the regime irrationally angry. They're dismantling the European economy for the sake of this never happened during the Cold War. There was no assistance to the Czechs or to the Hungarians when they rose up against the USSR. None whatsoever. But in 2022, Russia, long liberated from the USSR, could show its power around the world, not just, you know, Ukraine, which has been a victory from beginning to end. But this is in a Russian-speaking area, and Putin is moving very slowly for that reason. But in Syria, earlier than that, as the U.S., roughly around the same time the U.S. was driven out of Afghanistan. So, using the Ukraine in this way, the special military operation was the result of a very long time of work, thanks to Putin and his people, on restoring Russian sovereignty. And we know what liberalism is, a totalist and imperial ideology that accepts no opposition. Now, you contrast this, say, to the German economy, which has been shrinking. They are in depression status, a term no Western writer is permitted to use, by the way. Since the destruction of the pipeline, the Americans did, the Navy was right there, and the sanctions, Mercedes and all the, which I couldn't believe, that these oligarchs would say okay and dismantle their plants in Russia, where some of the profits were coming from. I'm sure they were promised something as a result. But according to official statistics, German economic output fell by 0.3%. It's likely much worse. We know that. Specialists all over the place have lowered their forecast for the German economy. The autumn report to the government assumes more and more shrinking. The economics minister in Germany, Robert Habeck, pretends to be more optimistic. He thinks that the GDP is going to increase by 1.1% in 2025. but that implies recovery across the board. But it certainly can't be measured in actual production, since that's not happening. Germany can't function without not just Russian energy, but the Russian market and their investments there. Habeck is a propagandist. He issued this manifesto in his position as economics minister. He calls on the state, which is odd, they're not the creators of economic development, to do something about all this. And he says, you, the state, should contribute to a noticeable recovery in the economic situation. I don't think he understands really how economics works. Why would he be writing a manifesto to government actors? He assumed all of this is going to work, but no one's paying a lot of attention to him. Everyone else, the World Bank, their own intellectuals and universities, they've lowered their forecast, which has been accepted by the state for 2025, from 1.4 to almost no nominal growth. They want to pretend there's going to be growth in 2026, but don't give an explanation as to how this could be. But even if these numbers come true, inflation is much higher than all of this, so it will be a shrinking of the economy. Now, we know that these growth figures are utter nonsense. That's predictions. Because, for example, the German automotive industry has collapsed. There's very few orders. And I know this because Markus Bolick, who is the director of the Association for the Automotive Industry, the German version, and he says, quote, the situation in the automotive industry in Germany is certainly very tense at the moment. This is also because we have framework conditions in Europe that are not competitive in all aspects. That's a lot of diplomatic code. Ultimately, it's because German manufacturers have had to close their factories in Russia and Belarus, not to mention the items that go into automobiles, you know, everything from fiberglass to steel to electronics, whatever. That creates a ripple effect, and all of that will fall. High energy prices, high taxes. Well, that may be true, but that's just a way to divert from the obvious. Their real problems have been described by me and others many times. But since your automotive is the flagship industry, its collapse is just a symbol of all of these concerns. The state is poorly run, subservient to the U.S., and now filled with hostile foreigners deliberately imported to use as a reserve army against any native German resistance. Financed by George Soros. I don't know if you came across, when I published this on Patreon, you'll be able to see it, Soros' own words from 2015 talks about how the EU is going to bring in, legally, 1 million Africans a year, and how he demands that the EU should provide $16,800, now this is a few years ago, 15,000 euros, per asylum seeker, for each of the first 2 years to cover housing, healthcare, and education. Well, they raise these funds by issuing long-term bonds. He says, finally, to absorb and integrate more than 1 million asylum seekers and migrants a year, the EU needs to mobilize the private sector, NGOs, church groups, businesses, to act as sponsors. He and his organization and BlackRock are clearly behind this. As prices go through the roof, as Germany is deindustrialized, this is the regime's demand. But this is because oligarchs or plutocrats rule for their own narrow interests. I wrote in my 2023 paper, many of you have come across it, Rent-Seeking and Asset Stripping, the Political Economy of Postmodern Oligarchy, and I said this. Even more, the left was mobilized in the U.S. and today in the EU to drive mass immigration from non-white areas of the world to staff its new economy in Europe. Illegal immigration is essential, low-wage core of the oligarchic economy. In the U.S., the Immigration Act of 1965 institutionalized an invasion aimed at replacing the intelligent white-dominated working class with malleable foreigners, many of whom were poor invaders quickly mobilized by the regime on whose behalf they would shut down any white complaint. And this is the purpose, ultimately, of the regime's obsession with this non-existent white racism, since it justifies these kinds of policies. But the overall production figures for Germany as a whole are poor. Around 10% this year below 2019. And if you have forgotten. Remember, in 10 years or so, at least they claim, no new cars with internal combustion engines will be registered in Europe. And we all know why. Now, whether that happens actually is another matter. No one wanted this. No one asked for this. But of course, as always, in an oligarchy, it will be imposed on the country. There are no new orders for German cars. No one knows where this electricity will come from for their electric cars. Chinese companies are outproducing them in every way because they're far more rational. I don't know, maybe the illiterate millions from Africa will help them. I don't know. Same thing for self-driving cars and all this nonsense. So in July this year, the German government came up with a comprehensive growth initiative, which I kind of read 49 measures that will boost production. Of course, it refuses to see reality. It's going to fail. The mood in retail has deteriorated. No positive development in private consumer spending is expected. Not to mention, no one in Germany trusts government or economic elites. And of course, nothing in these 49 items mention any of this. Now, of course, oil companies love the conflict with Israel and Iran because that is, the U.S. gets no oil from this area and hasn't for a very long time. Iran produces about 4% of global oil production. But this is all based on American policy and for no other reason anyway. Oil prices have gone up out of gouging, not a lack of supply. There is no, if anything, there's a glut of supply because of the collapse of consumer spending. But rising energy prices, whatever the cause, force all prices up, causing inflation. But that's not the real cause of inflation in late 2024. It's the lack of domestic production connected to the constant printing of money. That's almost a textbook definition. So, of course, the present inflation crisis will get infinitely worse with the oil spike. Since Germany couldn't get its oil from anywhere and gets most of it from, well, it used to be from Russia, but from Norway or offshore Britain, oil companies will gouge and then blame the Iranians for the increase. If Iran were to block the strait, the global economy would fear consequences, not so much from the lack of supply, but because it would be the excuse for oil prices to raise prices. They're talking about $100 a barrel. Journalists will say Iran is at fault. And you know this is true, since the U.S. doesn't get a drop of oil from the Middle East or Central Asia, but prices will rise in the U.S. too. The EU does get some oil from the region, however. So all of this comes down to the sanctions on Russia and this utter irrationality. You know, outsourcing is taking European industry and sending it to the third world. But they've also, thanks to Soros, has found it much easier to simply bring the third world to Germany. Well, we all know the good years of German industry are gone, and it's all unnecessary. None of it was inevitable. But that is the nature of oligarchy, not markets. Germany is in a deep depression. Government continues to send a fortune to Ukraine because we know harming Russian civilians is far more important, even than their own economy. And that proves what the regime truly is. According to the Kiel Institute for World Economy, France has spent maybe 540 million euros arming Kiev. Germany, 17 billion. And quite frankly, no real reason for this has been given, especially since the Kiev government has been soundly defeated. Further, we all know that these funds have all disappeared. Whatever physical products they sent are immediately destroyed. So it has zero impact on the war anyway. So whether it be German decline, the use of Ukraine as a battering ram, she's been long deindustrialized, none of that was inevitable. And at the very least, we know that the EU might be finished, and that is a very good thing. Well, I had a lot more this week to talk to, but I've got talk about. I've gone way over time, so I'll end it here. And I'll say, as always, thank you everyone for listening. I will talk to you again next week. Bye bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.